We are creatures of desire. What we most desire is meaning. What makes us suffer most is a lack of meaning.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Marital therapist, author, and communications trainer Andrew G. Marshall invites guests from all walks of life to discuss what makes life meaningful.
Hello, I'm Andrew G. Marshall. Welcome to The Meaningful Life. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, and wherever you find your podcasts. Is happiness the luck of the draw? Something in the genes? A natural talent? Or a skill that can be learned? My witness today is Richard Nichols. He's a psychotherapist, a hypnotist, and the author of 15 Minutes to Happiness, easy everyday exercises to help you be the best you can be. He has two podcasts, the Richard Nichols podcast and Therapy Natters. He helps run an Amdram theatre company, and he is a husband and a dad. So let's start right with nitty gritty. What do you exactly mean by happiness?
Ooh, now that's an interesting question because it is such a subjective word, let alone a subjective topic. It genuinely does mean something different to everybody else. And I've, as a therapist, I sit on fences, much to my wife's frustration, because when somebody comes to me for help, I can't tell them what to do. So my job is to sit in the middle and look at everybody else's perspectives. And what I've found over the years, when you ask somebody what happiness is to them, you do get different answers to different people. For some, it's the inclusion of a feeling. For others, it's the exclusion of a negative feeling. So for some, I know I'm happy because I'm smiling and I've got this nice warm feeling that everything's going to be okay. And you can reduce it down and pick it apart and go, well, that's optimism. That's hope. That's a feeling that there's something good coming around the corner. And others might say, I know that I'm happy because I'm not depressed. I am not negative. I'm in a good mood.
So give us an insight. Give me three things that make you happy.
In my hand right now, I shall pick it up. I've got a cup of tea. It's a cup of Red Bush tea. That's all it is. And when I hold the mug in my hand, it feels warm. And I like warmth. We're into spring now, so the weather's picked up, some of the rain has stopped, and I like the feeling of being warm. Feeling warm makes me happy. And maybe that's related to I have Raynaud's syndrome, so when my hands are cold, can't feel them. So feeling warm, that makes me happy. But if I'm honest, a lot of the things that make me happy about other people, and maybe that's what led me towards being interested in therapy, which was a strange experience, really. I became a therapist purely by accident. Maybe something that now I look back on can give me an insight into what makes me happy. Because I was, this was the year 2000, so I was 23, 24. Just got the internet plugged into a house I'd moved into. So I was yahooing, as it was in those days, random questions. How does something work? How does this work? How does that work? How does hypnosis work? And that led me on to training courses for hypnotherapy. And a light bulb went off in my head that said, there's a career here for you. This is something that ticks every single box. Because as a teenager, I was very interested in radio, wanted to work as a radio presenter, got a little disillusioned with it because of some of my friends and so on that were involved in it already, and they weren't enjoying it as well as I thought I would when I was 12. So when I saw that I could train as a therapist and I could still play with background music, I could still use my voice, because therapists don't usually do a great deal of talking and there's a lot of listening and feeding back and so on. But when you specialise in hypnosis as a therapist, suddenly you get to use your voice, you get to use words, language, and to get inside people's heads and figure out what language means to them. And that excited me so much. And it still excites me now. Words. Sounds ridiculous. They make me happy. I love social media. Even though Twitter can be an absolute poisonous rat's nest. But I get to connect to other people and listen to their words. All of these things. And I think it is about other people. What they've achieved, what they're sharing, the effort that they put in. All of those things. They make me happy. That and a nice warm cup of tea.
Because the reason I'm asking is because I have a bit of a rebellion against the idea of happiness.
my parents used to say things like, we don't care what you do as long as you're happy. And I find the idea of happiness something that's very fleeting. So yesterday, for example, I had an appointment with my tattooist to discuss my next tattoo. And I was excited and I was happy that I was going to do this. I'd had several days looking forward to it. And, you know, the consultation was over in sort of 40 minutes. And then I felt a real sort of low afterwards. It's fleeting. Whereas being mindful and actually being in the moment and actually not thinking, you know, is talking to Richard today going to make me happy? But actually being right in the moment and actually really enjoying our conversation and being really mindful that we're never, ever going to meet in this way ever again. So it's incredibly special. That, I think, is mindful. There might be happiness on the side. And what this podcast is about is finding meaning, which I think is sort of enduring when, you know, happiness is rather fleeting. If my tattooist had been ill, then the happiness would have disappeared. But they might be the, for example, the meaning I get out of the tattoo, what it's going to represent, is still going to be there whether the tattoo is done or not. Am I making any sense?
Oh, 100%. I think there's a lot of toxic positivity around these last 10 to 15 years particularly, and hasn't been helped with social media, people putting things on Facebook that are kind of meaningless, but sound great. I mean, it sounds like a good idea to live, to laugh, to love. But having a poster up on your wall isn't going to help your depression. And often I find that those sorts of quite trite things can make people feel worse, not better. There's a lot of problems at the minute in the world, and the UK has been in a great place for a long time. We're supposedly one of the wealthiest countries on the planet. So surely we should be happier than some others. But we almost never have been, I don't think. There's always been countries that rank above us. If somebody was to do proper studies and investigate people's subjective feelings, how they actually feel about themselves, how they feel about their life. And it's not usually correlated with the GDP. So giving somebody more money isn't necessarily going to help. But if you've got almost no money, then it's very hard to be happy. And there are people at the minute that are struggling and holding up a sign that says, why don't you live, laugh and love, if that's the way around it is. I can't remember. It isn't going to make them laugh, not in the right way.
So why do you think some people seem to be happier than others?
Frustratingly, it's a mixture of all sorts. The nature versus nurture debate has been going on for generations, and it's going to go on for generations more because it seems to always be both. We have this genetic disposition to mood. That is true. We can inherit specific moods through our genetics rather than through learnt behaviour. We've known that from studies with identical twins. If anybody has any identical twins, pretty much as soon as they're born, really, you'll get a knock on the door that says, would they be willing to take part in any little studies over the years? Because they're as close to a clone as you're going to get. And the slightest little nudges in their life, the slightest little positive or negative experiences can really send somebody on a different trajectory. And then you can monitor their genetics and see, look, these genes have been turned off and these genes have been turned on, yet these two are pretty much clones. Their genetics should be the same, but they're not because of epigenetics. Their genes get turned on and off through life, through divorce or frustration or a car accident or an assault or being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it's sending their thoughts in a slightly more positive or negative way. And what I want for people is to recognise, no matter where you are in your life, you can pull that back. If there's a trajectory you want, even if it's a neurological change you've got to make in your brain because you've hardwired in some habits, even if your genetics are against you, there's still work that you can do. You still have some control over your life to have an influence, to have an effect. And I think so many people are stuck in the, well, this is just the way I am approach. And that's not fair. People need to be told, no, It's not the way you are. It's the way you have been, and it's the way you feel right now. But there's potential for change, and let's explore how to make that happen.
So if you can make a difference to your level of happiness, what sort of things do you actually need to do?
I think it's worth looking at your individual values to see what you're interested in yourself. Because for some, it is about living in the moment. It is about feeling the warmth of the sun on your back. For others, it's about physical health, feeling their heart pounding. For others, it's about nature. For so many, definitely, it's about connections to others. And that is something that I find goes against what a lot of people assume. They think that having control over their life and being independent is what makes them happy. And it might be. And if it is, if that's for you, then that's where your focus needs to be. But for so many, it's about other people. It's about connecting to others. And that can be done so easily nowadays. This is the 21st century. We've got kind of no excuse, have we, to be able to reach out to somebody. Even if you've not spoken to them in 5 years, it's very easy to send somebody a quick text message that says, "Hey, stranger, I haven't spoken to you for ages and you just popped into my mind. Hope you're well." That might be all you need. Not only is that going to make you feel quite good because you've just connected to somebody, but it makes them feel quite good because they've heard from somebody they've not spoken to for years. You just popped into their mind, and that's a lovely little feeling. When I make that suggestion to people sometimes that says that this might be beneficial, so many people say, "Oh, no, that makes me too uncomfortable, the idea. It's been too long. I haven't spoken to them for so long." And I twist it round or turn it round and say, "Well, how would you feel if they did that for you?" And they say, "I'll be thrilled." I go, "Well, don't deny somebody else of that feeling. They could be thrilled that to hear from you." "Oh, yeah, but I'm anxious about doing that." "Well, okay, well, let's work on that. That makes sense. It's okay to be anxious about things that are unpredictable. You're maybe scared of rejection or whatever it is. But we have to be open to those possibilities of rejection if we want to connect to other people. And I think it is the connections to others that rather cheesily makes the world go round. That can be something so simple, though. That could be anonymous. You can have a connection to another person just by donating £5 to their GoFundMe account. You can make a connection to a complete stranger by leaving a post-it note on a bus with a smiley face on it that says, "Hi, hope you have a good day, whoever finds this." It could be that simple. What a difference that makes to somebody.
One of the things that often stops us connecting and getting stuck in our own head is sort of negative thoughts. And we can sort of start off by worrying, what will somebody think if I phone them after 2 years? And then you can get in a spiral where you start from that and then you start thinking, all these other people haven't phoned me. I'm not worthy of a phone call. You know, I think I'm going to go into the garden and eat worms. Can you stop yourself getting into that kind of spiral?
We can. It just takes practice, because anything that you do on a regular basis becomes habit. Even negative thinking, catastrophizing your thoughts, and therefore so can the positive stuff. But that can take a very long time to get into a habit of, if you've had a decade of pessimism and negative thoughts. But you've got to start somewhere. But I do think it starts with an acceptance of the thoughts first. We have to accept, this is the thought that I'm having. There's a part of me that is scared of connection, is scared of rejection, is scared of humiliation or whatever it means to reach out to somebody and then get ostracized. We have to accept that that's part of being human. If we didn't have an emotional reaction to that possibility, we wouldn't have evolved to populate the planet. We're very much a species that's evolved to work together. And so being ostracized is painful. And that's where the whole CBT theory, even though it is sometimes criticized for being too simple, it absolutely can help once you learn the basics. The absolute basics is might be all somebody needs about CBT, which is that your thoughts have an influence on your emotions have an influence on your behavior, and your behavior gives you a narrative, a story of who you are, which then forms your thoughts, your expectations, which then goes around and around in a loop. And it doesn't matter really where you start to challenge. Do you challenge your thoughts? Do you challenge your emotions? Do you change your behaviour? It doesn't really matter where you start, as long as you recognise, I've got to start somewhere in this process and challenge.
I think you want to start with the thoughts rather than the feelings, because I think we get our feelings negated all the time. We're not used to really listening to our feelings. So generally, I don't think challenging our feelings. I think we want to accept our feelings, and I think we want to challenge our thoughts personally.
Yeah, what I was thinking is that rather than challenging our feelings, yeah, we need to understand, why am I feeling this way? Because it's a signal. Our emotions are telling us something. It's driving an action. It's driving a desire. Whether it's right or wrong, our emotions could have got confused and gone, no, this is dangerous, keep away, when actually it's safe. But hey, thanks, brain, you're trying to help. But in that, we can change some of our feelings quite simply. We can reduce down some of our anxiety, if that's what it is. And it always is. We just call it anxiety, but it could be called guilt. We could call it shame. We can call it frustration, impatience, whatever. It's still fight or flight response. And that can be as simple as just taking a few deep breaths and slowing your heart rate down and relax. It can be as simple as that to go, okay, I've got a bit of adrenaline, my heart is pounding, I've got this sick feeling in my stomach, but I can bring it down 1%. And that tiny bit of an influence that says, okay, I do have some control over my emotional reactivity, it makes it easier then to change any behaviour you need to change, and then with the thoughts.
And I think when you investigate it and actually get the right name for it, I remember I have a fear of the dentist, and I was driving to the dentist, and I knew, you know, it wasn't just a checkup. They were going to do work, and it was going to be root canal and everything. And I was feeling,
ouch,
ooh. And I sort of checked in with myself and said, is this anxiety? Is it panic? And I thought, no, it's not panic, it's fear. And actually knowing that it was fear, not panic, and actually being able to name the feeling did really help. But I could have quite easily got into a panic place if I hadn't have actually checked what exactly is the feeling and actually putting the right name to it. Because I have a sheet that I send to my clients sometimes, which has the top 500 feelings that were got off the internet. One day, somebody trawled across the internet, so every time somebody said, I feel, they recorded the word. Most people can only register about 5 or 6 feelings. You know, I'm anxious, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm angry, and that's about it. And in fact, our lives are far more complex. There's at least 500 feelings, probably more than that. And to actually get the right word is really important.
Especially for men. Men have been cultured through life. I think it's going to change in the next generation, but even if it only changes 10%, it's still a drop in the ocean. Men have been taught that there's really only 2 emotions, anger and bravado, and that's it. If you're feeling anything, it's one of those things. When actually they're allowed to feel vulnerable.
I think they're allowed to feel lusty as well.
Ah, yes. That's a third one, of course. So we've got horny, we've got angry, we've got proud. But what about feeling lonely?
Connected.
Yeah, yes, yes. But in our culture, I know not all cultures around the world are the same, but here in the UK, we're awful and have been for generations. And I think we could do with acknowledging that.
So how do we challenge our thoughts then?
It starts with acceptance. We accept that this is the thought that we're having. If you want to sit down with a therapist or make you try and be your own therapist and work out where that comes from as a protective mechanism, you know, that can be useful in helping us to understand why it's there. And in that understanding of why that thought is there, even if it is just to protect us, we can then give it some challenging statements. We can say, thank you, brain. That makes sense. I understand why you'd think that. Maybe you give it a name. Maybe you call it David or Dennis rather than depression or negative Nelly or whatever it is. Call it whatever you like. It can just be you. Thanks, me, but I got this. Thanks, inner me. Thanks, child me. Thanks, Dad. You know, whatever it is, wherever that thought comes from, thanks for that. But actually, I think I've got this. Scary as this is, it's realistic. It's possible that I can do this. So it's got to be done gently. If we just deny it and say, no, that's not truth. That's not my truth. So no, there's going to be pushback.
So we have to be quite gentle with our thoughts, quite understanding, treat ourselves in the same way that we would treat a good friend. Give them some respect. Be our own therapist that says, okay, that sounds painful. Let's work on that.
And I think it helps to look at, in fact, perhaps write your thoughts down, because in your head there will be 3 million of them. When you put them onto paper, there'll only be about 30, because they just go round and round and round in different permutations of the same thing. And then look at whether they're a fact or whether they're a belief. You know, some facts would be, for example, my partner has left me. That's a fact. But there might be a belief there, I'll never meet somebody that will love me as much again, or I will love as much again.
Or simply, I'm unlovable. Mm. And having that belief, that is going to hold us back. If we genuinely do keep telling ourselves, because we've got this feeling inside of us that we're unlovable, we're not going to take any risks. We're not going to sign up for any dating apps.
It's a belief rather than a fact, because I'm sure that I could find somebody that loved you. It might be your mother, but there is somebody that loves you. You're not unlovable. It's just what might be accurate is your ex doesn't love you, or they might love you, but they can't live with you, which is an entirely different kind of thing.
Absolutely. But it needs gentle exploration to do that. And as we've said, with men, so often there's just this feeling inside of them, and all they've got is anger. They're angry about it. Well, what do you do with anger? You then behave in ways that are angry. There's lots of stomping about, which makes things worse. Punching holes in doors. I hear that so often from people. The kindest of men. And they say, yeah, I put a hole in the door. And why did I do that? Because it felt like the right thing to do at the time. Because you were, let's explore this. And they go, yeah, I was angry. Like, I know you were hurt. Eventually, once you play with it, what's beneath that anger? Oh, I was hurt. Okay, because this thing happened to you and it was painful. And it felt like the only thing you could do is punch a hole in the door. Good to learn about that. Ready for next time.
And I think what you're getting to is it's okay not to be okay.
Yes. And I know it's a phrase that's been bandied about social media for years now, and some people might think that it's overused. And every now and again, I'll put something on social media and I'll get a comment that says, do you not think there's enough mental health awareness now, actually? No, I don't. There's still so much more to do, because people are really, really struggling. And we do need awareness of all the things that make us, that make us tick. Our anxiety levels, our understanding of what our emotions are, is not being explored. It really isn't. It's a brief lesson at school, if you're lucky, every now and again. But it's the most important thing that's going on.
And even if you find it difficult to accept this idea, look at what the alternative is. Because otherwise, if you're going to beat yourself up for your pain, it's a bit like having two wounds. You know, fate sends you an arrow into your chest, and then you're upset with yourself that you're upset because you've been left by somebody. So you get another arrow, and shove it straight into the wound.
People can get angry about being angry. They can get anxious about being anxious. That is a story that people tell me so often. Like you were saying about the dentist, what starts off as, well, this is a difficult experience coming up and I'm feeling this feeling all about it. If we don't catch it in time and go, what's going on here? We can be anxious about that anxiety, which produces more adrenaline and cortisol, which makes us more stressed, makes us more panicky, which then we're panicking about panicking. And you ask anybody who has panic disorder, what are you panicking about? And they go, I'm panicking about panicking. Why are you anxious? You've got nothing to be anxious about. Oh, that's not how it works. This isn't a conscious choice.
And if you're not okay with the idea of not being okay, you sort of get trapped in the perfection kind of place. And that is really unhelpful. You tell a beautiful story in your book about trying to be the perfect husband and failing miserably with your wife's birthday. Would you mind sharing?
Yes, she wouldn't mind. It's fine. She doesn't listen to my stuff anyway. But she did read that book and she found it quite funny. Yes, this wasn't that long ago. So this was 2017. It was when I was writing. This is why it appeared as a chapter in the book, actually, because it happened at the time I was writing it, April 2017, my wife's 40th birthday. And I wanted it to be something special. It's her 40th birthday.
And a good husband would do something special for Absolutely. His wife's 40th birthday.
That's the belief that was in my head. And if I can't provide something very special for my wife's 40th birthday, then clearly I'm not a good enough husband. So it's got to be super special. And her birthday's in April, and I started thinking, what could I do in January, February? But the more I think about it, the more I don't really know what she wants. And then her dad bought her a car. I was like, it's not going to be that now, is it? Maybe if I work really hard over the next 6 weeks, I can pay off the mortgage. No, that's not going to happen, because that would have been amazing. Here's the deeds to our house. But no, it was thousands. It was just not going to happen. So I'm desperately thinking, what? So we go to Edinburgh to spend a few days for her birthday. She wanted to go and see the pandas in the zoo and see somewhere different. Edinburgh's a lovely city. It really, really is. Absolutely gorgeous architecture. And the whole place, what a vibe. It's lovely. This is the week before her birthday. And in my mind, I'm like, right, I'm going to spend a long weekend with my wife, all those shops in the city. She'll be able to pick a nice piece of jewellery, something very, very meaningful, something very, very special. Everywhere we go, I'm saying, hey, let's go into that shop. I want to get you something special for your birthday. She says, no, I didn't come here to go shopping. I'm like, oh, now I'm starting to panic. My birthday's on Tuesday, for example, and now it's Saturday. We get home on Tuesday. Well, I've got to rush off to the shop and buy her. I think I'd got her a card. That was at home waiting.
Oh, yippee-yay.
Yeah, I know. I've got her a card at least. But I'll rush off to the supermarket and buy her a chocolate cake for her birthday, because who doesn't like cakes on the birthday? But now it's the weekend and it's on Tuesday. It's got to be now. I have to get it now. This whole long weekend, which should have been lovely and probably was for her, in the back of my mind, all I'm thinking about is I've got her nothing, literally nothing for her 40th birthday, not a single gift, because I wanted something to be so special, so perfect, that she would always love me forever. And the meaning behind that was huge. And because it was so huge, she still got nothing. 7 years later, I still genuinely haven't got her anything for her 40th birthday. And she was gutted. She expected something for her birthday. It was her 40th birthday. Surely Richard's put some thought into this. Oh, yeah, put lots of thought in. I was thinking about it for months and months and months and doing nothing but thinking, I can't think of anything that's perfect. It has to be perfect. She'd have been happy with pretty much anything, but I couldn't get her just anything because it had to be perfect. And that's after 15 years of being a therapist. You'd think I'd know better. I'm just as guilty as everybody else of making these mistakes.
Has she forgiven you yet?
I'd have to ask her that. She understands. She understands why. Because I had to sit down with her and say, this is what was going on for me. And actually, the difficulties that brought up, because it did bring up difficulties, she was upset on her birthday. And that upsetness lasted a week, where she was upset with me. She was distant and cold and sad. And I caused that. That's all my fault, which then makes me spiral if I'm not careful. And I had to sit with her and say, we need to talk about this, because this is what was going on. And for us to get close again, for her to say, I was gutted. And me to say, yeah, so was I. I caused that. My need for perfection, my need to be the perfect husband, caused that. I did that. And this is why. And it probably brought us closer together. Who knows? There might be a universe where that didn't happen and we just got more and more distant as the years went on, and this is the year that she left me. I don't know.
Yeah, you could have bought her a piece of jewellery that ticked the box that, you know, was there was something opened on the day, and you would never have had the conversation, and she couldn't tell you that that expensive piece of jewellery meant nothing to her, because she could tell you went into a shop and said to the assistant, it's my wife's 40th birthday, I've got to buy her something, what would you like? And the woman says, oh, I would like this. And yeah, you've ticked the box, but you haven't been vulnerable in the way that you were.
Yes, and I think a lot of men do find it difficult to be vulnerable, because it's a sign of weakness to have made a mistake, to sit and cry with your partner. That's not an easy thing for people to do. And yet,
those emotions are there for a reason. We can't deny them. They have to be understood and accepted and listened to. We have to listen to our emotions. Like you were saying earlier on, you can't just change an emotion and that's all. No. Yeah, we can take a few deep breaths and bring our anxiety down, but you have to listen to what that emotion is telling you. Why is my body telling me this? It's driving something. Listen to it.
Now, what do you say to people who say, well, I'm perfectly happy, it's just my partner's in a rotten mood all the time and their mood pulls me down and infects me? It's often said along the lines of, you know, I'm a happy, positive person, but my partner is so blooming negative all the time and it's pulling me down and I can't be doing with it.
Yeah, emotional contagion. It's a real thing. We can walk into a room and it can just change us because there's a mood in the room. Well, if that's okay, and it is, then we need to do the opposite. If we know that somebody else's mood can influence the other person, then maybe we can influence the other person. But again, it needs to be done with compassion, needs to be done with kindness. If somebody's in a bad mood, you can't just say, oh, cheer up, don't be in such a bad mood, you grump. Maybe you can get away with what you can get away with. You do what's appropriate. But for most, we have to acknowledge the other person's in a bad mood. And it could be that they're tired. It could be that they're hungry. It could be that they're disappointed in something. Talk about it. Explore that. And maybe there's a story there. Maybe somebody's had a lifetime of the only way they've got any attention is when they've got something to complain about. We've all met the extremes of those, the drama queens. On the spectrum of that, there's a lower level there that says, this behaviour gives me meaning. This behaviour of having a little whinge, being a grump, that gets my needs met. Well, maybe you'd have got your needs met if you weren't grumpy. Look at what you need. But that needs communication. I think that's always the secret.
I think one of the problems with happiness is we often give up some of the things that made us happy when we were children, when we cross over the threshold into adolescence and then into adulthood. You know, we leave behind childish things. And over Easter, I did a series of workshops. There was a festival I was teaching there. I did other people's ones. And we had, there was a workshop for an hour and a half of just playing games. Oh. And there was a sort of a game where we had to pretend to be dead and there was bears that had to wake us up. And we played, there's a werewolf in the village
sort of kind of thing. Yeah.
And, you know, there were about 70 people playing this game, and we were playing Tig and all sorts of other things like that. And at the end of it, we had to sit down and we had to think about what our favourite childhood game was. And I wrote down Grandmother's Footsteps. Do you remember Grandmother's Footsteps?
Yes.
Yes. And then the question was, when was the last time you played, you know, whatever it is that you did? And I felt this huge sadness because it's been many years since I've played Grandmother's Footsteps. And we sort of give up playing with, I don't know, Lego or whatever it is that we enjoyed, because we feel that we haven't got time to, as I say, do Lego or whatever it was from our childhood that we enjoyed. So how do we get back to those sort of places where we play and we get that sort of just fun happiness again?
It's a shame that the only time we get to do those things is when we have children ourselves, and then later on maybe grandchildren, because not everybody does have children. Not everybody is going to be in a situation where they're going to be able to play these games.
And one of the problems is when people do have children, they take them to windsurfing and they stand on the shore watching them. They're not actually out there doing the windsurfing themselves too. They're just the taxi service that drops them. They have a fag and they talk to the other parents and then they take them home again. You know, they should be on the water doing windsurfing too.
I'm not sure why we have this belief that we're not supposed to, that those childish things are for the children. When I just got married, so 2003, I knew I was going to be a therapist full-time eventually. And I knew that that could be, all the things in the training was, you know, this can be quite a lonely profession if you're not careful. If you're working in private practice, you're only going to see your clients and that's about it. I knew I needed more. I've been working in an office or in a warehouse since I was 17. And then I was a manager in a civil engineering firm, and there was all these people. And I knew that what makes me thrive is my connections to other people. But the thing is about being a therapist is once you've seen them, especially short-term therapy, which I was doing back in those early days, I do more longer form psychotherapy now, but back in those days, it was just 6 to 10 sessions and that was it. All these people are just going to come and then go. And I knew I was going to get feelings of loss constantly. It was going to be a regular thing that I would make a friend, he says in inverted commas, and then they'd be gone. And that's the therapeutic way. They're gone. You never see them again, as it should be. So I knew I needed more. And so I approached my local amateur dramatic society, which a friend of mine was a member of from my old hospital radio days. And I did a play with them back when I was 15 at school, and they were still going. And he kept saying to me over the years, oh, you should come back, Richard. Come out and come back to that theatre company. It was really good when you had... Oh, yeah, maybe one day. And I realised when I was getting my priorities right, working out what I value, what makes me tick, that actually that is something I want to do. So I went back and I've been there pretty much every Wednesday since. And it is so much fun, but it's fun in a really scary way. The idea of to get used to that feeling of anxiety in your body, to feel yourself shaking and thinking, oh, have I got my lines in my head? Is this right? That's terrifying. But you learn to thrive on that. You learn to feel the fear and do it anyway, which is a wonderful phrase that I think everybody needs to embrace.
Yeah, I think that's a really wonderful piece of advice. The problem is we tend to turn our pleasures into jobs. You know, I used to play radio stations as a child, and then I became a radio presenter. You know, I used to volunteer as a marital therapist with Relate, and then I turned it into my profession. And that's the problem. Things we like, we turn into professions. So don't do something that's just entirely for fun. Okay, well, we'll talk some more about this in just a moment.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Please follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material and other benefits.
One of the ways you can participate in The Meaningful Life is you can sign up for our Substack newsletter. If you go to my website, you'll find a place to do that. And every 2 weeks, I'll send you a newsletter which has an interesting article. I have one at the moment, which is about the habits of happy couples. What do happy couples do? Well, you can find out if you sign up for my Substack newsletter. Go to my website, www.andrewgmarshall.com/podcasts. And you'll also find a way to participate by sending in a letter for me and my witnesses to discuss. And here is one I've got to discuss with Richard. During my therapy, I have identified that I have an internal safety officer who is forever sucking his teeth and saying, I don't think so. It's not that I'm planning anything dangerous. More, I've been hurt before by my parents, former lovers, life itself. And he has good reasons to be cautious. However, I'm beginning to think he's too sensitive, too ready to shut me down, so I don't take any risks whatsoever. If something goes slightly wrong, he waves his hands in the air and runs around screaming. How can I ever meet someone if he's shutting me down or telling me I don't have enough energy for going out? When I do go somewhere with potential, I'm thinking more of safety plans than being open to adventure. I want to sack him, but I think that might be too extreme. Any thoughts about how to have a better gatekeeping system?
Ah, love that phrase, a gatekeeping system. I think it's worth acknowledging, like we've been saying all the way through this, these things need acknowledging. There is a part of this character who is frightened, vulnerable, and he's frightened of vulnerability. That's okay. That's what it is to be human. And that needs to be accepted. But what I mean by accepted, that doesn't make it acceptable. Accepting how you feel is a way of understanding how you feel. And then to think, well, where does this voice come from, I wonder? Is it my voice? Is it somebody else's voice? Who is this gatekeeper? Now, as a therapist, it's tempting to look at the therapeutic techniques of visualization, having a little conversation with this character, with yourself, if it has to be. If it's your voice, then you close your eyes and you imagine having a conversation. You sit in a chair opposite and you talk it through respectfully and you listen to what that part of you is saying. When that part of you says, this is why I want to hold you back. This is the potential. These are the worries. And if we can get to a point where we can say to that part of us, okay, that makes sense. I get it. But if the worst case scenario happens, I'll deal with it then. I don't need to worry about it in advance. I have the resources that if something happens that's unpleasant, I'll deal with it then. I don't need to worry about it now.
I wonder if it's worth trying to sort of create some other figures in sort of competition. Well, not in competition, but part of the team, I think. So I'm sort of thinking a bit like a holiday camp. So they used to have red coats and blue coats and things like that, sort of entertainment officers, you know, somebody whose job it is to provide a bit of fun sort of kind of thing. Because safety officers would say, you know, we can't do this show, nobody will come to it sort of kind of thing. Whereas the entertainment officer says, but we've got this barn right here, we can put on a show now, sort of kind of stuff. So you sort of need to have an entertainment officer that's going to say, but it'll be fun, we could do this and we can do that. What do you think of that idea?
I love that. That's brilliant. I remember when the film came out, Inside Out, I forget now exactly who all the characters were, but that was the theme of the film, that there's inside all of us, there are these different emotions, these different characters that are driving all of these thoughts and feelings, and they all want their needs met. And that's okay to have all these parts of us that have got different needs. Or do they? No, they all have the same need ultimately, which is, I want to be happy. And for one, them being happy is being safe. If you're safe, you're happy. For others, it's, if I'm having fun, I'm happy. And those things are in competition. And the idea of having a team of people like these red coats trying to organise things. What I'm remembering now is the yellow coats from Heidi High, all these characters. But don't we need a health and safety manager that goes, you need a harness if you're going to go up there? Yeah, we do need security.
Yeah, best not to dive into an empty swimming pool sort of kind of advice. But it's unlikely there's going to be sharks in the swimming pool.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that I'm thinking about is scripts, because sometimes from our past, you know, we've heard that this particular correspondent has been hurt by parents, former lovers, and life itself. Mm-hmm. We can have some old scripts there. And that might be how you felt, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago when it happened, or these might be messages that you were given when you were a child. I think it's worth sometimes being 100% certain what the scripts are, because sometimes we're not able to be entirely clear. And then you can actually ask yourself, is this script actually still relevant today or not?
Life scripts, old tapes, however we want to call them, we have these internalized messages. And they were probably very useful, like you say, when you're 15, it was probably very useful. If there was a particular experience that somebody had that meant I need to keep my guard up because the outside world is dangerous or other people are dangerous or falling in love or connecting to others is scary because we're going to get rejected, then of course it makes sense that if you were rejected, you'd be hurt. If you've been ignored, belittled, we know a lot more now about attachment theory and parenting and so on. But like the old poem goes, man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. It really does. But until we understand that these messages belong at a different time, we can't challenge them. Because if we do, we're going against our life script. We're going against what we think is our meaning that's going to keep us safe. But if we can recognize, no, actually, this feeling, it belongs in the past. It's just an echo of the past, but it's an echo that hasn't faded with time. It's got stronger and louder until it dominates. Until we recognize that, accept it, understand it, we can't move on from it, but it needs exploring.
Well, I hope that was helpful. And if you want us to feature something of yours, www.andrewgmarshall.com/podcast and go to Take Part and you'll find a form to send in. So I have to ask you, as a witness on The Meaningful Life, what makes your life meaningful?
Ah, yes. I think we've covered it a lot on this recording so far. It's about other people. For me, what creates a meaningful life is connecting to others. It really is. Whether that's through my work, whether that's through the amateur dramatic stuff, whether it's through social media, whether it's through a post-it note left on a bus window with a smiley face on it. Connecting to others, whether it's a like on a social media post or going into greater detail, actually commenting on somebody's social media post, not just liking it, but actually saying, good on you, that was great, or hope all's well, anything. Knowing that somebody else is just briefly thinking about you and you're thinking about them is beneficial both ways.
And that's how we, in fact, connected and this podcast came about. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but not for everybody. If you become a supporter of The Meaningful Life, the conversation continues. We're going to be discussing comparison culture. This is when someone is always having more success, better behaved children, better sex, and more happiness than you. How do you deal with that? Because I think that is a real barrier to happiness. We'll be talking about that. And if you want to hear this bonus material, you can subscribe directly via Apple or Spotify. We're also available on Amazon Music. If you want to become a supporter of The Meaningful Life and unlock all of the extra benefits, here are the details.
You've been listening to The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. You can follow Andrew on Twitter, like him on Facebook, and please leave a review wherever you consume your podcasts. Making, editing, and distributing The Meaningful Life comes with substantial costs, and we'd like to ask for your help. Visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material for every program, send in a letter to be discussed by Andrew and his guests, and join a community of other people seeking to make their life meaningful. At the gold level, you get even more benefits. Production of The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall is by Michael Dooney. Social media by Madeleine Healy. Sound engineering and theme tune by Sebastian de la Luz Mendoza. And I'm Susie Colick. Please tell your friends and spread the word. Thank you.